Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
Well, it's been a long time coming, but we're finally doing a podcast on resistance training and strength work. And it's something that Ross and I have been talking about within each other's little lives as recreational cyclists, and just trying to make sure that we can stave off the age issue, although Ross is a lot younger than me. But today we have a very special guest, and we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the details, some of the weeds of this free topic. Our specialist today is comes all the way from Canada, and his name is Stuart Phillips. He's a distinguished professor and a Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Skeletal Muscle in Aging at McMaster University. And he's been conducting academic research for over 25 years. He's published more than 450 peer-reviewed articles, and he's a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine and the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences. And he really is, when you hear him talk, he talks with such authority and passion about the subject, because if he had to talk about somebody who was probably identifying himself as like Mr. Strength in the sports science community, he would be it, wouldn't he?
And he talks about it with ease, like, as well.
Yeah.
It's like having a conversation about what you did at the weekend. So, yeah, he is the authority, and that's why we've wanted to get him on it. And he became the authority, in my mind anyway, because in the early part of the 2000s into 2010-11, he did some work on strength in younger people. Now you'll hear he's more into the elderly population, that really challenged some paradigms around what you do in the weightlifting space in order to get certain advantages and so on, used and developed techniques to measure muscle synthesis that changed the way that these things were measured, and then they applied it. And so developed and trained a whole bunch of students. And so I remember going to a conference that World Athletics organized in Florida once, not Miami, just outside it, and he was presenting on strength. And I thought, this is not what I'm reading in books. Mm. This is cool, you know? And I think he's had a lot of pushback from the weightlifter community, because that whole space went like in its own direction. And then the science came along and said, hang on a moment, you guys are doing things based on conventional wisdom, but it's not right. And it's not what actually happens. And he's the one who pulled that in the right direction. So
we've actually got this topic going up on our discourse channel at the moment, and it's been one of our more popular topics on that channel. And this is the reason why we wanted to get Stu. We had to book him sort of 3 weeks in advance, and I think what you'll hear in his interview with him, that there's lots of things that I was quite surprised. I thought I knew a lot about strength training, because we've run a lot of stories in Runner's World and Bicycling magazines, which I edit here in South Africa, and I thought I kind of know what resistance training is. But there were so many things that he said, and I went, I almost had to say to him, can you just repeat that?
Because I wasn't sure.
Did I hear you wrong there? There's quite a lot of surprising things that he talks about, so that it changes your perception of what resistance training really is, because I've walked away from that conversation with a completely different attitude towards it.
In a few ways, yeah. And I must say, some of the conventional wisdom I think he punctured when I heard him probably came from your magazine.
We try our best.
It's true, though, because... Yeah, I don't know how you call them zombie ideas, you know, like they've been proven wrong, and they still continue to roam the world and attack people with their falsehoods. But yes, he challenges those in a few domains, and the one that we start with is health, right? So resistance training is a health benefit, because there's a paradigm that says that if you want health, as in a longer life, less risk of disease, there's a very specific type of training you do, and it doesn't involve weights and body weight. It involves cardiovascular, run, cycle, walk. And so that's the first part that we shake the tree on today. And then we talk about...
Well, that's the perception that people have. But yeah. It isn't...
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, so that's what that's the first part. And then the second part is, once you've bought into why, you now need to discuss how, and he'll challenge you there as well. So I think on both the purpose and the practicalities, Stuart is going to, I hope, give you lots to work with. And I mean, you said now, even as we're preparing this, when you listen to him talk, he makes it sound real simple.
Yes.
And so,
I made it so confusing in my own head. Absolutely.
So you might get to the end of this podcast and say, like, yes, that's actually quite obvious. But then maybe, A, it would have been successful. But I promise you, it's not as obvious to learn this as it is to explain it the way that he does, you know. But just before we get into that, like, your New Year's resolution was to do weight training. How's that gone?
Not well.
And same. I had the same resolution, and I reckon I've lifted about once this year.
Yeah, I think I've been to the gym 4 times. I bought a gym membership to do that. And I think, and you'll hear this in the conversation, there are lots of reasons why people don't do the resistance training. There are many more people who do the aerobic exercise, but very few do the resistance. And you'll hear why that is. And it makes sense to me. But it also, what you end up listening to at the end of this podcast, you realize, actually, I can do this, actually. Not just because I'm motivated by the benefits, but I'm also motivated by the fact that actually it is possible, and it's not as onerous as we think it is in our own heads.
And I think as well, and this came up in discourse because Gareth started a chat about it and why it's so difficult. And I remember saying, like in the endurance space, which is the one we know, running, cycling, you could advise someone how to start. But for some reason in the resistance space, and maybe it's because we're outsiders that we have this perception and it's not even true, but there seems to be this underlying thought that there's a perfect way to train. And if you don't do that, you're wasting your time. And that's not the case. And that's what he's going to explain to you, is that don't make perfect the enemy of good. And definitely don't fail to take the first step because you don't think you can take the 100th one. Just move. Go in some direction. Lift something somehow. And in a week's time, you'll lift a little bit more. And that's definitely the challenge. It's hard, right? And we didn't even get into it. The first thing that'll happen is you'll go into the gym and you'll lift and you'll be hurting the next day and the day after that and sometimes the day after that. But go back on the fourth day and lift, and then you won't hurt on day 5, 6. Mm. You might hurt a little bit, but a little bit less. And you just have to constantly be moving and going in the direction you want to go. And don't, I just think that this field has created for itself barriers to entry and progress, and Stuart is going to hopefully show you that those are, while it's not entirely figments of your imagination, could be pretty easy to sidestep.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
So, Stu, welcome to our podcast. And I know that we've been trying to get you on our podcast for a couple of years now, and we haven't been managed to get all of our schedules connected and make sure that we can do this. But it's very exciting to have you on the show. And I think for Ross and I, one of our sort of New Year's resolutions at the beginning of this year is that both of us, who are kind of part-time amateur cyclists, wanted to start thinking about getting into the gym. And I went and got a gym membership, and I'm still battling a little bit with the motivation to get into that. And I think some of the stuff we're going to talk a bit about is what the barrier to doing weight work and resistance training and why it happens. And I think we've got real stories that we can kind of share with you that you could potentially advise us on. But I think what's really exciting about this is that you did a review study, which we're going to use a lot when we talk to you today, about the benefits of resistance exercise versus aerobic exercise and why it's the perception of resistance exercises about is slowly but surely changing. But let's kick things off a little bit by kind of knuckling down to the basics. Can you just define what we mean by aerobic, and can you define what we mean by resistant exercise?
Sure. Yeah. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. I'm glad that we could get our schedules to collide or coincide, whatever. Traditionally, we've had a more broad, I think, interpretation of what is resistance training, although it does rankle some feathers because the old guard would sort of say is it has to be, heavy weights that you can only lift somewhere about sort of 8 to 12 times. When you begin to extend beyond that, so and it doesn't necessarily have to be weights, could be your own body weight or pushing against an external resistance, legs, arms, shoulders, whatever. And we say something that you can do probably upwards of about 25 to 30 times. That's tough. The folks who would more traditionally subscribe to the heavy weight is the only way to do things would say all you're doing is developing endurance. But I think we can all agree that, once you can do something about, 100, 200 or 1,000 times, like turn the crank on a bike, that's endurance. But then to take the example of the cyclist, so a track cyclist who is, going to explode in a sprint, for example, that person has developed obviously some aerobic capacity, but has explosive power as well, which is the domain of strength training, but developed rapidly. Sprinting and end of things. So I think they share a little bit more in common than we like to paint them as sort of, diabolical extremes. And it's always the bodybuilder here and the marathon runner here. And I'm like, well, those guys are like 5 standard deviations beyond what's normal. So.
And I think what's interesting, a lot of your research has gone into the effects of resistance training, particularly in as you age. And kind of briefly, if you could summarize a little bit about why do you think that is so important in this day and age? Because it seems to be there's a big trend towards people who are aging.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been at McMaster for 27 years now, and I think the first you could probably divide my career almost in half by saying the first sort of 13, 14 years we did a ton of work in younger individuals, and great work. We've got a student population, everybody was gung-ho. We could take lots of muscle biopsies. We learned lots of mechanistic stuff, interaction between nutrition and resistance training, and good information. And then, a few years ago, once I took over the Physical Activity Center of Excellence, that's a community exercise program for people. The average age of the participants is about 73, and I'm getting older. It just sort of dawns on me that these folks are all sort of struggling for the same types of things, but it's not a medal around their neck, or it's not a PR in a race or something like that. But it's the strength to be able to do activities of daily living. And the, I think, I want to say popularization, but broader understanding of the term sarcopenia or age-related muscle loss is now beginning to work its way into the language of primary care physicians and people who understand what it means to quote unquote age well. And it's definitely about pushing back against that age-related loss and, aerobic exercise, awesome. But a lot of activities that limit these folks when you talk to them are strength or power related. So it appears that there's, a little portion of their lives that would be made better if they were engaging regularly in resistance training.
But just before we chatted to you, Ross and I were talking about the analogies of how you can perceive what resistance versus aerobic. And Ross, I'd like you to sort of repeat what you were talking about, what we thought about in the 80s when it came to that. And I actually wanted to know if you were, Stuart, if you agreed with this analogy, because I'm not necessarily sure whether I agree with it actually.
I'd like to know why, but it might be about to age you relative to me. I don't know why, but for some reason in my mind, I refer to like 80s pop culture and I think of aerobic. And if you said to me, first image that pops into your head, if you say aerobic, I think Jane Fonda and leotards.
And the first image for me, it would be Richard Simmons, but the same era. So.
And if you said resistance training or weightlifting, I think Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are my 80s icons for dichotomizing those two forms of exercise for sure.
So we've date stamped ourselves. You can tell us your opinion in a moment. But the point I was trying to get at in preparing for this with Mike was, it seems to me that almost like there was a paradigm split where we created like two poles of exercise. There were these normally guys, but not always, but normally guys who looked and wanted to look like Arnold. And then there were these people who wanted to look like Jane Fonda. And then at the same time, there were marathons that were growing in popularity. I think the New York and Chicago and Boston marathons went from in the low thousands to the tens of thousands almost overnight. Like there was this massive surge. Remember in an Anchorman, they made fun of it, saying they were
yogging.
It's a soft J, it's a yogging. And like there was a, and now it feels like having read your piece and seen some other articles you've been quoted in, and certainly reading your X feed, you're now trying to push back and say that this split, big bang of understanding of exercise was unnecessary and unhelpful. And actually now we're seeing a, what you call a coming of age of resistance training. So that's kind of the context in which we want to explore this. But before we go into that, what's wrong with Jane Fonda and Arnold Denison?
Well, the reason why, I don't have a problem with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but Jane Fonda, I always imagine because it's a kind of a gym-based activity, it feels like that is resistance training rather than aerobic.
Okay.
Because you're kind of using body resistance as your resistance measure. I mean, it sounds like semantics to me.
No, maybe it's important semantics.
I'm interested to know how that is perceived as aerobic, because Jane Fonda didn't necessarily make it aerobic. It was about strength and aerobics to some extent, from what I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. I don't know. Like I said, Richard Simmons is somebody, you know, sort of bouncing around and trying to burn some energy. But I mean, take the term aerobics until Ken Cooper coined it, while he was in the military. And the use of, you know, I'm going to aerobics was, you know, generally like, or step aerobics was a class that I think I would characterize predominantly as, you know, burning some energy while dancing and following an instructor at the front that may have had some resistive components to it. So you were stepping up or you were lunging or you're doing a few things. But the predominant characterization is you could do it for 35, 40 maybe even longer minutes. So I would call it predominantly aerobic in nature. And to Ross's point about, you know, in the 80s, it was this dichotomization, and you looked at Arnold Schwarzenegger and that was the epitomization of strength and musculature and et cetera. Drag it back a little bit though. And Jack LaLanne, who is, you know, iconic in the field, was wearing a jumpsuit and showing people how to be fit and strong. Jack was muscular, but he could do a lot of things where he was aerobically fit well before Arnold, but he just wasn't the same size in terms of his persona or his reach or anything like that. But certainly if you were a woman, and this is where I come into it, in the 80s, you did not aspire to be Arnold-like. You just looked at Jane, or you wanted to get thin, quote unquote. You wanted to be slim, and that was an aerobic based, outcome. So, you know, now we're talking about trying to re-educate a generation of women that grew up with the idea that, and you know, if I had a dollar for every time, I don't want to get big and bulky, and nothing could be further from the truth.
We'll come back to, in particular, Kenneth Cooper, because when we talk about the shift in thinking around this, because you've posted recently on Twitter, X, whatever we meant to call it. And by the way, you can follow Stuart at MackenProf. We'll put that in the show notes, but just so you know, it's at MackenProf. A couple of quotes from Kenneth Cooper. But can we just like consolidate our understanding then of aerobics as something that is thought of or can be thought of as endurance-based, lasting in excess of 30 minutes, and primarily would elevate heart rate and oxygen consumption? Would that, I'm asking Mike now specifically.
Yes.
As we move into this, because we're going to talk about the health benefits of the two types. Is that a satisfactory definition, do you reckon?
Sounds like it's a good definition. I think when I think about aerobic, I think about the fact that it's more, I guess it is about the number of how long it lasts. So yes, if you can do something repetitively for more than half an hour, it must be aerobic. Yeah.
Which is not to say that a 5-minute run is not aerobic.
No.
But you get what we're getting at, I think.
Yeah. Neither is how do you define then 100-meter swim? You know, that would also be anaerobic, I guess. An 800-meter run, you know, it becomes difficult.
Heading down a rabbit hole here.
We are, but anyway, let's by the definition of that, we can assume that resistance training involves pushing against something, which is what I like, rather than something that you're always pushing against something in the same breath.
What's an academic definition, Stuart, of resistance training, like for the purposes of what we're going to discuss here, do you think?
I think it would be, the aerobic would be continuous low intensity activities that predominantly elevate heart rate and respiration. If it's exercise, so it's programmed with the goal of improving fitness, whereas resistance training would be higher intensity lifting of external loads, including body weight, with the purpose of increasing muscular strength / power, and or hypertrophy. I mean, okay, that you pull that right out of an undergraduate textbook, it would sound something like that.
Yeah. So let's dig into this review that you did, and maybe you can just give us some idea about why you decided to do this review, particularly around the sort of coming age of resistance training, because what you've done, you've taken all the research that you've confounded. What's the topic of it again? I haven't got it on top of my mind.
It's published in the ACSM's Health and Fitness Journal. It's called The Coming of Age of Resistance Exercise as a Primary Form of Exercise for Health.
Yeah. So what motivated you to do this review?
Yeah, so two things. I mean, when you talk to most people and you say, you know, if you're not exercising, what's the form of exercise that you could do? And the lowest entry barrier is, well, I could go for a walk. And, you know, I'd never dismiss, you know, walking as a fine form of activity that everybody can do. It's cheap, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of benefits. I do think, as I said, when you get older, you're going to begin to notice that, you know, not that walking becomes an issue, but certain activities, going up and downstairs, getting in and out of cars, in and out of chairs, these sorts of things are strength and power related activities. And a lot of what we call activities of daily living are reliant on strength. And so the paradigm becomes one of, if we want to age optimally, what do we have to do? Definitely be aerobically fit. And I think, you know, the Cooper longitudinal study and everything else like that, and now the use of VO2 max as a fifth vital sign in predicting mortality risk, morbidity risk. And there's similar data for strength, just not as much of it. But it's starting to become apparent that the health effects that we predominantly ascribe to aerobic type activities actually have a lot more in common with resistance type activities. So, you know, the impetus for the article was, well, if we need to be fit and strong, because we know that's better than being fit or strong, then we need people to realize that resistance training is a big deal, because when you look at engagement in those activities, I mean, this is self-report, far fewer people engage in resistive type activity than they do in aerobic type activity.
And that's just purely because, as you say in the paper, there's lots of barriers to entry around being at a gym and paying for memberships and having weights and those sort of things. I mean, is that fair to say that that's the problem with people not doing resistance exercise?
Well, I think there's that, just try and imagine saying to somebody, let's say they're 65, 70 maybe, you know, you need to start doing some exercise, and you know, they're like, oh, I could go for a walk, and you go, and you need to do some resistance training. You need to lift some weights. And they're like, how do I do that? Like, where do I start? How many times do I do it? Do I lift free weights? Do I do this exercise before that exercise? Will I hurt myself, et cetera, et cetera. So the barriers are numerous. And I know if you get on Twitter at people, because I hang around with a lot of people that talk about resistance, their perception is that the barriers are like, absolutely, you know, what do you mean there are barriers? And it's so easy because it's so easy for them, or so easy for the clients that go to them, who are, you know, those are highly motivated individuals. If you're seeking to pay somebody to show you what to do, that's not the average person. and you know, how can we simplify this to make it as accessible as possible for people, and as easy to understand as possible? Because I think it's, if you go to the programming level that the strength and conditioning guys really want you to go to, and say, you should say guys in a gender neutral sense there, because women do it too. It becomes very, very complicated. You have to lift this. You have to do that. And I'm like, no, you don't, unless it's entirely compatible with some sort of training outcome that you want or an outcome you want to achieve.
Just in listening to you even say that, though, you realize how entrenched certain things are. Like, I know that if I went to my folks and I said, you need to get fit, they would both straight away go to walking, like Stuart just said. They wouldn't think about resistance training. And then the other thing that's interesting is you described it as you need to be fit and strong as opposed to one or the other. Yeah. I reckon what we want to aspire to is a understanding that fit is strong or strong is fit, that those are not two separate concepts, right? Like you'd be pushing to make people understand that an element of fitness is strength. And at the moment, they're sort of positioned as two separate bits. And that's why no one thinks of it.
Yeah. Well, we'll stay tuned for, I think, an update from the American College of Sports Medicine. I might be spoiling a spoiler here, but of an updated definition of what fitness is, because you, to your point, you're exactly, I mean, fitness we traditionally think of as it's heart, lung, aerobic, and VO2 peak. And that is fit by a lot of definitions. But if we put the circle around everything and say to be truly fit, is to have balance, is to have, you know, be flexible, and is to be strong / powerful, then to your point, it's a vastly expanded definition of what fitness per se is. And so may be coming.
Philosophically, I think of fitness in a Darwinian sense is how well adapted are you to your environment. And the problem, I think, is that as you get older, like your environment becomes unsurvivable because you can't get up the stairs. I remember my grandmother couldn't get up the stairs. She lived in a flat. She used to spend a week at a time upstairs. Couldn't get down. I mean, dreadful. And then you realize that actually the fitness, if you understand fitness to mean I'm adapted to my environment. I said it before on this podcast. I see my folks when we travel, can't get the luggage off the moving carousel because the power that it takes to lift something that weighs 16 kilograms while it's moving past you is a little bit too much for a 70-someone-year-old. That's a fitness issue, right? So that's the call to action here is be fit by getting strong, I think.
Yeah. I couldn't put it any better. I mean, we can all select sort of tasks that, you know, people fail at, and, you know, hopefully there's somebody there to help your folks grab the bag and put the bag in the overhead bin and all this sort of thing. But, you know, even the fundamental activities of daily living, as you mentioned, up and down stairs, or you modify certain activities that you know are strength related to do less. And so, you know, instead of taking a stair, you're like, forget that. Like, I'm going to get the elevator. And then the more you do that, the worse things get. Or I'm not going to, you know, get in and out of this car. I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, and it just becomes a situation where, as you say, the environment that you live in and you navigate in, it begins to get smaller because you squeeze things out of your life. And ultimately, you know, physical frailty is where this all ends up. And then you fall. And then when you fall, you know, it's a catastrophic event, right?
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, talking about how resistance training and aerobic training, there are similarities in terms of what the outcomes are and the metrics. Give us an idea, because my perception is that if you're doing aerobic training, you are lowering your cardiovascular, you're lowering your cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You have more functional VO2, you can run, you can cycle fast, et cetera, et cetera. How do you, when you compare that with resistance training, does resistance training give you any of the benefits that aerobic training traditionally has?
Yeah, exactly. If you look in the article, we try and draw a picture where, and I've always used, I don't know why, but blue and red. So, you know, blue exercise over here, red exercise over here, whether one's resistance or aerobic. And it was sort of like, you know, aerobic gives you lowers cholesterol, lowers blood pressure, does all the great things from an aerobic capacity. And then when you look at resistance exercise, it also lowers blood pressure. It doesn't improve blood lipids quite as much, but it's there. But when we talk about type 2 diabetes, it actually doesn't matter which one you do. There's a lot actually to be said for doing resistive training, because muscle is, it's like a furnace, right? And it's the largest site of postprandial glucose disposal. So the more you have of it, the more active it is, the better you can regulate your blood sugar. When we talk about anxiety, depression, it appears that that's more effectively treated by resistance training. When we talk about dementia and lots of other things that become age-related issues, again, it's resistance maybe and aerobic, but both work in the same domain. So instead of sort of having, you know, these are all the diseases that resistance training does, and these are the diseases aerobic training, they actually have much more in common, with the exception, I think, and you know, there's always sort of the strength and power will always be the exclusive domain of resistance training. And aerobic fitness will be the exclusive domain of aerobic training. Like it, if you want to maximize one or the other of those, then you have to do that activity. But from a disease or health perspective, much more in common than different, for sure.
So in other words, if, I mean, we can almost move the conversation along to the, not just the age, the aging population, because we are all getting older, but also to talk about athletes in the same breath. If I am a person who's older, or if I'm an athlete, is it then advisable to say, right, I'm going to train four times a week. Most out of that four times a week, I'm currently walking four times a week, or cycling four times a week, or running four times a week. Should I now replace one of those sessions with a resistance session a week? Because the benefits of that will be better than just doing 4 days of aerobic training.
Yeah, I mean, it entirely goal dependent, right? So, you know, people ask me, you know, what am I training for? So I have no competition on the horizon that I'm training for, but the horizon is, you know, hopefully decades in the future, and I'm training to age well, if that's the right way of saying it. So, you know, I have to, you know, walk the walk, talk the talk. So to your point of this individual, not that the cycling isn't awesome for them and it's great. The point I think to try and sort of give you a cue on this is a lot of people think that you can sort of put off resistance training until you get older, because it's when you're older that it matters. But it's a little bit like, you know, sort of money in the bank. So if you accumulate the benefits earlier, we're all aging, so we're all going downhill at some point. No matter what anybody says, exercise just slows the decline. It doesn't reverse it. But the point would be that it's like bone mass. So the best bone mass we have going into a period when we lose, and women have been taught this for years with menopause. It's the same thing with strength and power and muscle. For older men or older women. So start with something high, and then we all begin to go downhill, and hopefully you don't hit that threshold where tasks become difficult and disability becomes an issue. You know, in your 70s, hopefully you're dipping into it in your 80s and your 90s. And so, you know, maybe that's a long answer to your question of effectively saying that cyclist would be better off from a health perspective, holistic health perspective, spending some time lifting some weights. And it may be heretical to talk about giving up one, you know, cycling session a week to do a weight training session. I'm sure you could find weightlifters who would say the same about, you know, I think they need to cycle as well. So I think that it is a better. And everything that we've got the one figure that we completely stole from somebody else with their permission to look at hazard ratios. And when you look at people who aerobically train versus strength train, everybody's good compared to a control, but people who do both are always better in every category: obesity, heart disease, et cetera, et cetera.
And so, performance?
Depends on your what your interest, right? So if you want to be strong, and you know everybody says, why would you lift lighter weights, which is sort of the paradigm. I don't think it's not our paradigm. We just maybe brought some awareness to it. People say, well, you need to get stronger, and I'm like, listen, if strength is what you want, then definitely practice lifting heavy things, because that's where strength comes from. If power is what you want, so you want to move something fast, then practice doing that. But to the extent that, you know, if you're 65 to 70, I don't know that we have an optimal, although people will say that they do, way to prescribe weightlifting. Weightlifting and doing it is, I think at this point we can say, is optimal. Doing it is not optimal, but the what of doing it is different.
There's a few things you said there that I definitely want to come back to, a couple. I did want to make one point is, as you described this idea of starting young, it's almost like you could think of resistance training as an investment into your like neuromuscular retirement fund. That's the thing you're going to cash out when you're older, right? But
yeah, I love it.
Because even as you said it, I know there'll be people listening to this maybe who themselves, but maybe they've got parents, siblings, whatever it is, who haven't made that investment. And for them, I think the call to action is even more extreme, and it's not futile. The fact that you haven't saved for that retirement fund doesn't mean that it's too late. Like, so I just want to underline that. Like, those, for those people, this is even more important, because now you can do it. It's never late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Two big things. First, the biggest, and I mean biggest by a country mile, change and benefits that you get is when somebody who does little or nothing starts doing something, even if it's, like I said, walking or, picks up some 5 and 10 pound dumbbells, like big changes. Maybe not, massive that they feel, but from a health perspective, that's the data. We know that for sure. Mm. And the it's never too late to start is, that's a huge mantra of mine to try and tell people, because we get people coming into our center who do at age 65. They're like, I've heard that we need to, and I'm like, it's never too late. Like and we have some data now actually that from our own participants that shows that over 2 years, the women in particular, instead of going down as they normally would in a 2 year span, go up. So they're not really reversing aging, but they're definitely flattening out the line for a period of time. So they're making an investment, albeit a little later in life, but it's definitely paying some dividends for sure.
Mm. And then the second thing, and this is a little more technical, you mentioned the hazard ratio. And in the name of like improving the quality of my pitch, when I take this to friends and parents, can we just go into like what the hazard ratio means? And then very, very specifically, the magnitude of that reduction in hazard ratio as a function of strength alone, aerobic alone, and then both. This is incidentally, I think it's figure
one. Yeah, you better explain what you mean by the hazard
ratio. Yeah. So we've got to unpack it and then describe its value. And I think it's figure one in your paper, so people will have access to this.
Sure. So the hazard in the end is mortality. So big hazard for everybody. Now the rate of mortality, to be very clear, holding constant at 1.00. So, nothing we've done yet we're all going to die, right? The point I guess is in a given period of time, if you took 100 people who were doing nothing, 100 people who were doing the aerobic training work, 100 people who were doing the strengthening work, and in a given period of time, how many people died? And the control group is the reference. The strength training group or the aerobic training group is less than. So they're reduced by, so if it's 0.8, they're reduced by 20%. Mm-hmm. So you can talk about 20% fewer people dying in a given period. So it's sort of like, I call it the first past the post measure. So you get this, but then when you do the both together, it's usually that the hazard ratio is even lower. So even fewer people died within a given period of, it's usually, 5, 10, 20, whatever, however many years. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's one of the points you can say to somebody that we've pushed your hazard or your risk of dying within a given period down.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So just for example, now all cause mortality. So now you're going to die. What's the reason? Any reason at all. Without any training, it's one. With strength training, it's 0.85, 15% less likely.
Yeah.
With aerobic training, it's 0.76.
And with both combined, it's under 0.6. So that's this, that's now giving you an idea of the scale. Type 2 diabetes, strength training reduces it to 0.55, aerobic training 0.5, and both together under 0.4. That's a 60-odd plus percent reduction in your likelihood of type 2 diabetes causing your death as a consequence of the combination of training. So as a pitch for that retirement fund, these are massive returns.
Yeah.
If I can run with the financial services analogy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's important to talk about this combination of both and the benefits of the combination of both things. It's not one or the other. It's the combination that seems to work. And it's not one that's better than the other either. They both have different functions.
Yeah, no. And you know, I've gotten myself in trouble maybe a little bit on social media by, you know, sort of pushing the strength training narrative. And my reason to push is because so few people do it. Like, the number of people that engage in aerobic activity and meet the quote-unquote guidelines, I imagine they're similar in your part of the world. But let's say the WHO, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous, et cetera, probably about, you know, older people in Canada, 30 to 40% self-report, that they meet those guidelines. The number of people that self-report, they meet the strengthening guidelines, which is 2 days a week of engaging in muscle and bone, they call it, strengthening activities, which is broad. It might not be exactly the type of activity that I might like them to do, but it could be like a power yoga or a Pilates or something like that, which are great forms of activity, but I would prefer people lift progressively heavier weights as they get stronger.
Go on, Stuart. Okay. I interrupted you.
Well, so my point is that far fewer people report doing that than meeting the aerobic guidelines, and far fewer still report doing both. So
what I was going to ask is, on that issue of how much should I do, I know that in the cardiovascular space, if I can call it, like, for now, we'll keep that boundary, that unnecessary boundary around it. Like, there's a lot of debate, right? Some people will say the 10,000 steps thing. Other people, even within the ACSM guidelines, there are not conflicting, but different minimal effective doses that are recommended. Is it 30 minutes of vigorous or is it 60 minutes of moderate? Is the understanding around the minimum effective dose of resistance training as disputed and controversial? You've said 2 days a week, but is 15 minutes 2 days a week enough, or does it need to be an hour 2 days a week?
Yeah. I wish I could give you a good answer on that. I mean, there are some analyses out there that have taken a stab at this. The main issue is we just don't have the volume of data in the resistance training area that we do for aerobic training. And so I can't answer that question as well as you could answer it for aerobic. And as you point out, even some of it is a bit controversial for aerobic. I mean, I think one of the things that really kind of blew up the whole aerobic side was when high intensity interval training came in and said, look, you can get this benefit in this period of time. Like, it's so if minutes per week is really the outcome, then we can shorten that down to very, very short periods if the intensity is high enough. And you could argue the same if resistance training were whole body and you just went from one exercise to another and you did, you know, 4 or 5 repetitions and the last repetition was fairly tough to do. I'd say you're getting tremendous benefits from something like that. So it could be 2 15-minute doses if the intensity is high enough, or it could be 2 30-minute doses, something like that. It does appear that the health effects probably after about an hour a week begin to wane. In other words, you've squeezed everything out of the cloth after doing about an hour. So 2 30-minute sessions is amazing. And again, I know I'm going to rankle a bunch of people who, oh, you need exactly, you know, we don't know. We just do not know. So what we do know is that 2 is better than 1. 1 is better than 0, but 3 probably isn't much better than 2. Now, if all you want to do is lift weights, I'm never going to say stop. But I do think like a lot of aerobic exercise, you know, too much of a good thing, not good either. But most people are just not hitting the guidelines. So I'm talking about entry level buy-in for somebody. Let's try and get 1. Can you give me 1? And can you give me 10 minutes, 15 minutes? And I can give you like a circuit, you know, weight, body weight, or weight workout, and I think you'll get some tremendous benefits out of it.
And that kind of supports the argument that you also hear from a lot of people who do CrossFit, because CrossFit's got that sort of 20-minute sessions. Yeah. I mean, if you go onto the CrossFit.com site and look at a session, it's 20 minutes. It's high intensity, but it's also strength in the same place. So what you're saying is there's quite a lot of benefit, because you always think unless you go to the gym for an hour and you're working out for an hour, you're not getting benefit. But what you're saying is actually that's not true.
This is the paradigm switch, right? And so, you know, three doors down from where my office is, it's Marty Gabala, right? So he's high intensity interval guy. And I tell him, I'm like, you know, you just changed how I used to run my show, because I used to think unless I went for a run or got on the bike and slogged it out for 30, 40 minutes and came back like a dripping sweaty mess, it was a waste of time. And now I think I've got 30 minutes total, so I can get on the bike. I can do, you know, some HIIT intervals. And I agree, maybe I'm a little different than most people, but I can get off the bike after doing five or six. I'm a little bit sweaty, so I do need a shower, but I can get back and into the office in 30 minutes. And I've done a ton for my health and VO2 max and that sort of thing. So it's the same with resistance. We just don't have the granularity of the data to be able for me to tell you exactly how much and for how long and what type. But I'll settle for the doing of it as opposed to the not doing of it. As you know, let's try and get. It would be the same, I'm sure, for the aerobic guidelines as well.
And then the other thing is, you asked earlier about performance.
Yeah.
Now, obviously,
can you roll this all down into performance?
There's a whole, and Stuart sort of answered it, there's a whole separate discussion around performance. Because if I'm training to run a marathon in 2 hours, 10 minutes, let's say, or even under three, the endurance load demand is quite high. And then the resistance training time available becomes potentially constrained. But you could also flip that and say, we've pitched so far to the listeners the benefits of resistance training from the health perspective. But remember, there are also quality of life perspectives away from performance, but there are performance benefits in terms of strength and function that will improve performance. I know when I was running, if I wasn't doing some resistance training, I was much more likely to be injured and I didn't feel as athletic. Even as a cyclist, I feel more athletic having done a few sessions of resistance training. And I know that may sound absurd, like what's athletic mean on a bike? But there is you feel something because you're just in control of your own neuromuscular system and your joints a little bit better. So there's definitely a performance benefit, but it's a quite different conversation about how you structure that compared to what you do to get the health benefits.
Yeah, that makes sense. Stu, would you agree with that? I think that's a pretty good answer.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it used to be, you know, 80s talk was runners never lifted, lifters never ran.
And,
you know, there's still camps of thought around that. But I think now, even the occasional runner would, if they do resistance training, you know, to Ross's point, they talk about feeling better. Definitely their injury resistance is, we know that is a little bit better. And there is some work, not too old now, but showing improved efficiency, even in short distance runners. So, you know, 1500 meter, 3000 meter, 5000 meter. And it's not, these are not the type of workouts that bulk people up. These are resistance training workouts done with lighter weights, but the runners get more efficient. I'm sure the same is true of cyclists, although the, you know, it's squeezing efficiency out of somebody who's on a bike is maybe not as easy as it would be a runner. But the converse is also true. Like if you're in the gym and lifting heavy and that's all you do and you do it all the time, I think that there's definitely a need for you to mix in some aerobic exercise, because there are some cardiovascular outcomes from an arterial stiffness standpoint and cardiac dynamics that would indicate you need a little bit of the aerobic side of things. You know, I'll mention it too, but, you know, for people who are interested, and I can send you guys the link, is that the American Heart Association just came out with a revised scientific statement on resistance training for cardiovascular health. And so it's, you know, even when the American Heart Association says that, everybody stands up and takes notice. And, you know, I was pleased to see that, because, again, it puts it on maybe not level footing, but it at least heavily endorses the fact that you can get cardiovascular benefits from lifting weights.
How do you do that? I mean, I'm just paying the question. How do you get cardiovascular benefits from lifting weights?
Well, so there's the what we call traditional risk factors. So it's lowering of blood pressure, it's improvement of cardiovascular fitness, although it's relatively small compared to aerobic exercise. It's lowering of blood lipids, as we would traditionally ascribe to be the exclusive domain of aerobic training, but it happens with resistance too. And then it's other secondary health benefits that we're beginning to realize. So improvements in sleep latency, reductions in anxiety and depression incidence, all of which are associated with poor outcomes with cardiovascular disease. So I think that, when you look through the paper, there's a lot of things that you say, well, these are aerobic benefits and you get them with resistance too. And then these are secondary health effect benefits that arise as a result of engaging in resistance exercise.
When I hear how, I get excited because I'm thinking scientific mechanisms.
Yeah.
So if I can make I don't know anything like the detail on this, but I would love, I'd love to explore it at a sort of superficial level with you, Stuart, is the process by which we adapt to stress, and let's call exercise a stress, involves by definition having to switch on some genes and do some molecular work. There's molecular machinery that has to be built inside our bodies. And that is all the consequence of like these signaling pathways where the stimulus causes a little signal and that signal gets passed along and amplified and so on. And in the end, the genes are activated. And I think what the last decade has done, maybe two decades, has shown that the resistance training actually activates the same switches or slightly different switches by a parallel pathway to what the cardiovascular training did. And that's how. And that has implications for what we'll get onto, I think, in a moment about whether these two types of training actually can cancel one another out. But in general, they complement one another. Like, is there more substance you want to add to my very basic molecular signaling pathway model of
No, I thought your molecular signaling pathway model was awesome. I have a PhD student right now who's doing exactly that. And the point that he makes in that his lit review that I was just reading the other day was it exactly as you point out, a lot of these, we call them canonical, they're highly preserved signaling pathways that we say, well, this is an endurance pathway, gets turned on with resistance exercise. So as a generic stressor, and exercise is a stressor, the responses are relatively, again, more in common than are different. Now, is the more you train and specialize in one thing or another, so the more cycling you do tend to get, we call it a refined response. It becomes more dedicated to creating an aerobic muscle per se, and lifting you get a slightly different adaptation. But for most mere mortals that are doing both and in the middle, much more in common than are different. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. So yeah, molecularly the adaptations are different, but they don't necessarily clash or oppose as we once thought. And I think that's been an evolution, you know, in the last at least like 15 to 20 years, all these concurrent training, like aerobic, then resistance, then aerobic, that if you do them together or if you do them on one day versus the other day, there's definitely, you know, not much interference per se. And you tend to end up with a muscle that's better in all domains than better in just one.
Can we explore that specific example of the fear you mentioned earlier? Lifters don't run and runners don't lift.
Yeah.
This fear that if I want to specialize in one, I mustn't do the other one because it's going to undermine whatever benefits I get. And part of the thinking around that was because of molecules and signaling pathways, one of which is called mTOR on the strength side and one of which is AMK, AMP kinase on the resistance, on the endurance side. Do you want to just give us a brief overview of how those two switches interact with one another?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally the thought was that when you were trying to produce a lot of energy and maintain ATP, which was the aerobic side of thing, not you're not trying to do that in resistance too, but that it's all about burning energy and trying to regenerate ATP, that switched on AMPK, and that's AMP activated protein kinase. And that turned off mTOR, which is the key signaling protein for turning on new muscle protein synthesis. Whereas when you resistance trained, you turned on mTOR, and that led to the accumulation of proteins. And, you know, turning on AMPK activated all kinds of pathways associated with making new mitochondria within the muscle. Once again, like you said, if you look generically speaking, particularly in untrained people, they turn on everything, and the adaptations are very nonspecific. The more specific you get into your training, the more you tend to hammer one pathway or another, but they don't really oppose each other in that traditional sense as we once thought. And particularly, you know, when you sequence workouts, which most athletes do, some people go to the gym and do both, but most athletes definitely, they train aerobic or do something in the morning, and they lift in the afternoon, or they lift on this day and train on the other day. And, you know, some mixed sport team athletes, rugby players are a great example. I mean, those are big, strong, powerful people, but that have to run around a pitch for 80 minutes as well. So that they're not aerobically unfit either. So they have to maximize the best of both worlds. And somehow, you know, but basketball players would be the same thing. Soccer players too, and maybe not as great an extent. But so you have to do the training. And you can't have one person just be a lifter and never be a runner, or just be a runner and never be a lifter, which is maybe what, you know, rugby players did 25, 30 years ago. They ran a lot because they needed to be fit. Some were bigger, or some were lifters. And then some just happened to have the best of both worlds.
Is it fair to say that if your objective from training, resistance training, is hypertrophy, bulk, strength, or all three, and you do that resistance training in a fatigued state because you've done a high volume and intensity of endurance training before, that you might undermine the benefit because of some competitive effects of AMP kinase with mTOR. But if you did it in the other direction, so the principle then, and advice we'd almost give listeners is you if muscle hypertrophy and strength is the priority, you probably do it first and follow it with endurance. Is that outdated thinking on my part?
It might be, but I think when you look at as far as I know, the sort of professional levels, I'll say, and where people sequence training, and you know, this is part of their whole being, is it matters a lot less than we once thought. So I don't necessarily disagree with, you know, aerobic first and resistance second, but it goes through periods where you might do the other one and operate in an aerobic scenario and incorporate skills, but under muscular fatigue, because that's a game scenario. So, but let's say that I think that most coaches and athletes program things so that one does precede the other, but I don't know that it makes as much difference as we once thought.
So moving on to a more specific question, is it fair? Well, here's the question. Does strength equal mass when it comes to muscles? In other words, is a big, strong guy who looks big and strong like Arnold Schwarzenegger strong? And yeah. If that is the case, is the way that you train for strength different to the way that you train for mass?
So I think people used to think so. My take on this, and we had a chat on X, a little thread going just the other day, is that, you know, bodybuilders have big muscles, but people traditionally say they're not as strong, let's say, as power lifters. So power lifters who lift one thing, one heavy thing, and just do it once, lift very differently than bodybuilders. They're not as interested in bulk, but they're still big people. The difference would be is if you get a bodybuilder and they practice lifting like a power lifter, in other words, just did power work, like, you know, the 1RM all the time, they get strong. So it's a practice phenomenon that dictates why a guy with ostensibly big muscles isn't as strong. So if your goal is to lift heavy stuff, then practice lifting heavy stuff and then that's the adaptation you will get. If you just want to get bigger muscles, then it appears that the key variable is volume. You have to do a fairly large amount of work. You have to do lots of sets within a session. You have to do lots of sessions within a week to your tolerance limits, of course. And it really doesn't matter whether it's heavier or lighter weights within a range from, let's say, 5 repetitions to close to failure or 25 repetitions close to failure. Everything works. Your muscles grow to your genetic capacity or extent. And then having said that, the only thing that makes you stronger, like you, of course you get stronger, but is practicing lifting the heavy weights. So strength and mass are intimately tied, but maybe not to the degree that we once thought. Like if you were bigger, you were always stronger, but that's a practice phenomenon.
And so, and that practice component is at least in part because significant contribution to strength is neural.
Exactly.
And it's not, yeah. And maybe you can define neural better than I can, but it's partly coordination. But a message to listeners, if you've been inspired by what you've heard so far and will continue to, and you decide to go along to the gym, you'll get strong really quickly without getting big because you get a neural adaptation that comes quite far in advance of any muscle adaptation. So there's almost two collaborating adaptations that drive what you can lift, which is to say strength.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the biggest thing you'll notice if you've never lifted before and you start is your strength goes up very, very quickly. And that's essentially your brain talking to your muscles, I'll just call it more efficiently, and your muscles behaving the way they activate the fibers inside more efficiently. And so you get better at doing the lift. And so, yeah, your strength improves, you know, dramatically, rapidly, but your muscles don't appear apparently that much bigger. If the outward appearance of your muscles is something you want to maximize, then you're going to have to wait a little bit longer and just appreciate, like, everything else. You know, we take 100 people, we put them in a training program. Some people get, you know, awesome. It's the same with muscle growth. You know, some people grow big muscles. That's just their, you know, genetic, you know, they pick their parents wisely. And some people don't. So same old story. You can do lots of things to manipulate how you grow muscles, but it's probably some sort of interior intrinsic biology that limits what and how much you're gonna get.
And at that point, when you're looking for muscle growth and development size, if you want to call it that, hypertrophy.
Mm-hmm.
As hypertrophy said, it means, in other words, building muscle.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Breaking down and building it up.
Yeah, not even breaking down. Like it's literally new. And actually, let me not say this so confidently because I might be completely wrong. Is it new muscle cells or larger existing cells or both?
And it's larger existing muscle cells. The concept of generating new muscle cells is, at least in humans, we have no data that that actually happens.
Right. So it's enlargement, and that is a function of volume, and some really interesting work that you've done, which I gather every time I see an interview you talk about it, there must have been some blowback when you first published that work. Bird and then Mitchell, and basically what Stuart showed is that the prevailing wisdom was that you lift heavy and you get bigger.
Yes, that was good. That was my next question.
And going back to, I think Bird was 2010, Mitchell was 2012. They found that actually it's the volume and specifically the lifting to failure, because it's when you fail that you've started to act well. It's only then that you've recruited all the muscle fibers. So then all those pathways I mentioned that switch on to drive muscle synthesis, that's when they're on, is after failure. So that's the key, not low rep, high weight.
The more reps give you bigger bulk, lower reps and heavier weights give you more strength.
With certain fine print that Stuart will now explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think generically speaking, that's a good sort of, you know, summary of how things work. I mean, you know, once again, to go back to, I spent way too much time in the gym when I was young, lifting weights, but I always lifted weights for a sport, which was rugby predominantly, or ice hockey, one or the other. And it was all like the big rage was like a 5x5, like an East German lifting sort of paradigm with, you know, East Germans won everything in power sports. They were probably getting some help, but at the time, the conventional wisdom was it blended heavy weights, which made you stronger, but you got the volume effect as well. And so you got bigger as a result. We spent a long time in the gym doing 5x5 sets for, you know, bench, 5x5 sets for a shoulder press, 5x5, you know, like it was an inordinate amount of time in the gym. And so the question we asked was, you know, if you lift lighter weights and you just lift them and you still go to fatigue, there's a principle that says you still recruit all the muscle fibers to try and do the work. And that's really what counts, not that you're lifting it using a heavy weight. The heavy weight induces that sort of neural connection that gets the coordination, and that's what makes you stronger. But it's the amount of just sort of total work and constantly activating your muscle fibers, or what we call volume, that drives muscle growth for the most part.
So the study, like the Mitchell one.
I mean, that goes against everything I've always thought about in terms of weight training.
Happy to puncture the dogmas.
I mean, it does, really.
Yeah, thinking.
You go to the gym and you see those big muscly guys pushing weights, and they're pushing heavy weights because they want to show their mates that they can push heavy weights. But in fact, the reality is they're probably gaining that muscle mass purely because of volume rather than the weight.
And fatigue, right? That's the stimulus. Yeah. Like it's volume to fatigue. So for instance, the Mitchell study 2012, I'll put the link in the show notes, is 30% of a one rep max compared to 80%. And the 30% causes more muscle synthesis than the 80, as long as you do it to fatigue. The 80 can do the same thing as the 30, as long as it's to fatigue. But the fatigue seems to have been the common element in that study, right? And that was a confirmation of a study 2 years before by Bird, similar design. It was 30 and 90 in that particular one. So, yeah, I was actually this morning, some of the coaches I work with at the running academy, because we're giving the kids strength training now, there was a big argument about this exact issue. And that same paradigm persists there. Is let them lift low volume, or if they want to not bulk up, they must lift low volume. Well, actually, if you're not careful, that's the thing that's going to do it.
This bulk up fear. So first, you know, congratulations on getting weightlifting into kids, because it used to stunt your growth and everything, and that's complete balderdash. We know that now.
We'll get to that in a bit, actually. But yeah.
So the whole concept that, we don't want kids to bulk up. Like I always say, and particularly women, you know, I'm not interested in bulking up. And I said, listen, if you start to bulk up, you let me know, and we'll change something in your program. You know, there's a specific way, and, you know, and I've yet to have somebody, you know, bulk up yet to the extent that they go, oh my God, stop this. Like, what's going on? You know, it's, or a child that, you know, it's ridiculous. It's a myth that just has to die, that people will gain this. It's like useless bulk. So the big folks you see in sports, and like they train in very, very specific ways, but plus they've got a genetic gift to do what they do, right? They've self-selected because probably they realized at some point that they were much stronger than other kids. And then they lifted a few things and they got pretty big. And then they're like, you know, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But we lined 100 boys and girls up against a fence and said, everybody run across the field. It's random until puberty hits, and then all of a sudden, you know, we begin to get these strong boys becoming men, women too. But at the same time, we get people that are just ridiculously fit. But not everybody bulks up. Like it's just weird, you know, sort of concept, and that's going to damage runners like somehow. It takes a very specific way of lifting to bulk up. And it predominantly takes just lifting. Like, you know, if you're running, all bets are off.
Yeah. Is there a danger, though, for a runner or a cyclist now who is interested in strength for all the reasons we've discussed, but not bulk, and then they come along and they say, you know, all I do in running is I train to fatigue. And so I'm going to take that same model of thinking, fatigue, into the gym, and I start to do light weights because I don't want to bulk up, and I go to fatigue, and I end up achieving exactly the thing
I'm more likely to achieve exactly the thing I'm nervous about. That's why this message is so important. Because
there's some good research on this now that's showing that in the lab and in the two studies that you mentioned, and there's another training study, Morton and Aikawa, that followed up with two separate groups, low load, high load. And we essentially recapitulated the Bird and the Mitchell papers. The main point is that in the lab, we take people to like the last repetition is like, we're helping them with it. You can hold one or two repetitions in reserve, and that's a phrase that's often used, repetitions in reserve, and still get all the same benefits. So you don't need to go to flat out, drop down, I need to throw the weight on the floor type thing. You can hold a little bit in reserve and still get all of the same benefits. So it's not absolute flat out fatigue, but it's very close to it. In the center, where we have older folks coming in, we have Borg scales everywhere, and their rating of perceived exertion is their external cue, but internal auto-regulatory. I'm like pushing this weight and I'm close. And then all of a sudden there's one or two reps that I could do, but I don't need to do those. I don't need to go to fatigue or total failure, and I can stop here.
So what you're saying is that the actual entry into doing resistance training is lower than what people perceive. In other words, doing something and doing something to reasonable fatigue, it's not necessary to go there and push massive weights to fatigue every time, because the benefits, even at a fairly entry level, are quite significant.
Yeah, I mean, I use effort all the time to explain it to, quote unquote, mere mortals who are interested in this, and say, I show them the Borg scale and I said, 10 out of 10, if you were to lift a weight, it's like your arm is doing this sort of thing, or you're like, absolutely, like, you're, you know, and they're like, yeah, I can understand that. I said, I don't need you to be there. I need you to be like, the last one is like, okay, that's hard. I could maybe do a few more of this, but you don't need to. So I talk about effort being in the sort of, the Borg scale is up there in the yellow range or the orange range. And so that could be, a 7 or an 8 out of 10. It doesn't have to be a 10 out of 10. In fact, most days, well, never do we ask the folks that come into our center, I'm like, I need a 10 today. Some come in and that's what they strive to achieve all the time, and like a lot of athletes, right? That's awesome. But most people come in and they're like, okay, like I feel like I worked out, like I got some benefit here, but it doesn't need to be some, knock down, drag them out. We need to resuscitate somebody at the end of the workout.
And that's aside from the fact that if you are not familiar with this training and you're doing a movement that you're not technically competent at, there's a risk of injury, and that risk of injury is going to appear much, much larger at the point of failure and fatigue. So just stay away from that danger zone, here be dragons.
100%. And, this is where we really get right into it. When I talk about heavier weights and I talk about risk for injury, a lot of, strength and conditioning folks say that the risk is negligible with appropriate training. And I'm like, you're right. Absolutely. I probably agree with that. And they point to literature showing the, risk rates and everything else like that. So my take is that actually in resistance training studies, the injuries that occur, or sort of niggling, we'll call them injuries, are vastly underreported if they're reported at all. And that's just because people in this science, which is relatively young, are not as familiar with how clinical trials should really work. So adverse events need to be reported. We need to understand that. But having said that, I always point out, I'm like, but surely you appreciate that with a heavy weight, the risk for an injury is greater. But not if you're, and I'm like, okay, but we'll agree to disagree on that. But the one thing that does predict injury ridiculously well, it is fatigue. And so we don't need to go there all the time. And as you say, you know, try to do things that are beyond reasonable capacity, because that's when the system fails. And then, you know, so that's the other ethos of my training these days, is don't do anything that's going to put you at risk of not being able to do what you want to do tomorrow. So,
And so I suppose that the practical advice, and it's not to say that we want to impose a barrier here, but the one thing I would say someone needs to be mindful of if they first embark on resistance training is that if they lose control of that movement, or if they perform that movement in the suboptimal way, then they need to maybe rethink about that. And that's why if you are going to make an investment, it's to have someone make sure that you're doing them right technically. Mm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Look, if you're at all intimidated, if you have, like, I have no idea, and you have the means, then you know, instruction and personal training is a great idea. Find somebody that's certified, knows what they're doing, hopefully has worked with people in the age group, or and if you have a chronic condition, with people who have your chronic condition, and understands your goals, right? I'm not training to do this. I'm not training to become an Instagram, TikTok model. I'm looking for, some reasonable strength, that just to, you know, sort of be able to do a few things. And because I've heard this is a good thing for me to age well.
But if you don't have access to that, don't let it put you off, because I still think most people in the basic movements, like the bench press, the bicep curl, the shoulder press, I think most people would have a sense for when they're in control of that movement and when they're not. And I think the point Stuart's made is you don't need to have a weight heavy enough to cause you to fail. You don't need to do enough reps to cause you to fail, and you don't need to do enough sets to cause you to fail. So just stay below, like, where it goes from orange into red, and as long as you have control, like, you're benefiting.
Yeah.
So absolutely. The other thing I will mention just real quickly is you say, if you don't have the means, I mean, there's a ton of free information and videos on YouTube that are dedicated to body weight workouts, or workouts using elastic bands, basically. And these things have changed over the last, particularly 10 years, to include, for a very small fee, sort of $30. They've got clips on the end, they've got handles. You can, you know, press with these things. You can press over your head, you can wrap them underneath, and you can squat with these things. You don't need a weight. You need something to give you external resistance. And the bands, because, you know, the more you push them, the harder they get to push, mimic an aspect of weightlifting, which is very beneficial. We have a trial ongoing right now in some very frail older individuals, and they master these things. It takes about 3 or 4 sessions, and they're very good at them.
Mm. Well, so let's take, for example, just for want of a better example, a 54-year-old guy called Mike, who's a recreational cyclist.
Asking
for a friend, yes. Yeah. And I go, right, I got to do some resistance training.
Yeah.
Can I go to the gym and just do the circuit? Or is there a specific sets of exercise you should look at based on the sport that you do? Or is just going to do a circuit where it does your entire body in a 30-minute session regarded as resistance training? And is it good for you?
It's entirely goal dependent, right? So I have no qualms with a body weight circuit, and you know, if you can do that twice a week, and that fits your this is strength training for me, I'm good with that. The fundamental exercises, there's pushing. So pushing, you know, either on your back or seated, there's pushing above your head. There's pulling, and then there's leg work, which usually involves, you know, extending your legs. And so the squat would be, so it's a bench press, it's a row, and, you know, so, or some people might argue a deadlift, picking a weight off the floor, and a squat are the three big muscle sort of maneuvers, but they're things that take some practice to do. So lots of different machines will give you the same benefits, can make you stronger. You don't necessarily need, you know, anything in terms of specific equipment. if your sport demands one or another of those things, very few sports demand that you push a weight sitting on your back, but everybody wants to know how much they bench. But just about every sport, at least, that involves lower body stuff, there is a push involved. So you should incorporate something that incorporates that lift. If you do it as a circuit, it's great. If you go from one exercise to another, you'll notice by the end of the workout that your heart rate's probably up to around, you know, pretty decent intensity of exercise. So you're getting that benefit as well. You can do it in a short period of time, you know, all kinds of benefits. If you want to get more specialized, then you begin to split your routines into, you know, there's a push workout, there's a pull, there's a legs, or there's an upper body, there's a lower body, or you split it even finer. And one day is, you know, sort of back and biceps, then chest and triceps, then shoulders, then, you know, so you can get much more complicated. But if the entry level barrier is, I just want something that's going to do something good for me, then I think the circuit workout is a pretty good bet.
And fixed weights versus free weights?
No issue on that. To me, preference, availability. People will argue one versus the other, but I think it becomes one of these sort of nuanced, tiny details in you know, signal hidden in the noise, basically. So it's the doing of it that's far more important than the prescription of the individual weights and the patterns and everything.
Are there any special considerations in women?
Nothing. The interesting part is that women, maybe because they started a much lower level than a lot of men, can make some pretty profound gains in terms of strength and function. They tend not to gain muscle as to the degree that men do, but obviously it's all relative. You know, women come into resistance training programs with less muscle. But at the same time, they can gain a little bit of muscle. As they get older, it becomes a little bit more difficult for men as well. But they get very, very strong. So, I think it's the same type of advice and like a lot of things. I mean, don't start doing something that you think, oh my God, I hate this, because it's never going to happen. But, definitely if you can find something that's enjoyable, it could even be, and a lot of women talk about, you know, weightlifting being a very intimidating experience because there are big men in there and everything. And, there are gyms where it's geared towards women, and the idea of breaking down barriers for women to be able to, and I'll say this for CrossFit gyms, you know, and there's a real love-hate relationship with CrossFit, but it broke down barriers for, well, lifting for starters, and it broke down barriers for women lifting barriers more than any other, I think, sort of, you know, epiphany moment in the resistance exercise world. And so women now see lifting, I think, as much more, it's okay to be stronger, because that's part of being fitter as a woman. And that lifting is normalized. It's tough in the populations that we have, because, you know, women, you know, in their 70s and 80s, exercise per se was different when they were in their teens and 20s. But lifting weights for them was just a diabolical no-no. It just, you know, why would you do it?
And then the other population, and then I got one final question, is adolescents. You did allude to it earlier, and actually children as well.
Yeah.
I would assume that as long as you're technically proficient and you're careful, that there's no real other considerations. What could a parent or a coach expect of a teenager or even a preteen who starts to do a bit of resistance training, same as an adult or not?
Yeah. So listen, I need to give a shout out to Avery Fagenbaum, who helped us write the section on the updated, soon to be published ACSM position stand. And Avery is on Instagram. I know he probably doesn't get a whole lot of love in there, because he just pumps out his little infographics, but they're spot on. And his whole point is that there is nothing, and when I say nothing, like literally nothing, that should be a barrier to having kids practice exercises that make them stronger. It could be weights, it could be their own body weight. Like when we have kids do push-ups, like that's a pushing, strengthening exercise. So nobody ever thought, oh, push-ups are going to harm our kids' growth. But using external weights is, you know, all of a sudden people get, oh, I'm going to do this. It will not stunt growth. It will not stunt growth. It could lead as a gateway if your kid is interested in this into different sports and even an avenue of physical activity that they wouldn't otherwise do because they don't like walking. They're not a very good runner, et cetera, that sort of thing. But tremendously positive effects for children, adolescents, preteens. Insane times to, you know, start lifting in terms of benefits. Nothing. I can't think of a single thing that would make me say, you know, your kids shouldn't do that or your adolescents shouldn't do that. Safety is the number one concern. Yeah. Don't get into lifting for, you know, and young boys in particular. I want to, you know, control first, form second, the lift and everything else, the strength will happen. That's just kids. They grow, they get stronger. The coordination, and now again, the spillover benefits. They tend to do better in school. It's an association, so I don't know. Self-confidence, self-esteem, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Athletic performance just flows from there. But if give him a follow on Instagram, Avery Feigenbaum. He's a fantastic resource in this area.
Yeah, we'll do that. Is there anything in the theoretical concern around a developing human? And I'll say for boys and girls, because I'm sure what you've just said, we must say, let's get girls into gyms as well.
Yeah.
That because they're still developing and those growth plates aren't fused and so forth, that the advice you gave earlier for adults about staying out of the red, not pushing into fatigue, is that more important in kids? Or is it actually just a function that your muscles are going to fail so far in advance of the bone that actually you're never going to get to that risk?
Yes. So the bone growth stunting issue is a non-issue. It just doesn't happen. So there's nothing, at least that we know of, that says that, you know, kids are going to not grow because of this. I still do think that, the biggest thing is to work with control and form first, as opposed to, I'm going to put, you know, multiple plates and this kid's going to get as big and as strong. That's not the focus. So the focus should definitely be on, well, first, let's get kids into it. And if they're not doing it, second, let's do it safely and enhance their sort of enjoyment. And hopefully they see some performance advantages. And then at the same time, like, I think one of the things is injury resistance as well, particularly. So we'll talk briefly about young girls and young women who have increased risk of like ACL tears in certain sports, soccer and basketball. And people have said, why is this happening? And I think a lot of it's happening is because they're as skilled as the boys or the young men, but they don't have the muscular strength to be able to support the maneuvers that they're doing because they were never told to lift weights because, you know, it was important to be fit and to be a skilled basketball player. So I do think that resistance training might have some injury resistance imbuing properties that we're missing out on. But let's just say it's form and over, you know, the try to do everything heavy type mantra for sure.
Mm. And then last one from me, and this is totally something we could spend an entire podcast on. So I'll create a boundary around the question, and that's that this person, this hypothetical Mike at 54 we were talking about, who's taking to resistance training now because of its benefits and maybe replacing a little bit of endurance, is there anything you need to do with diet in order to optimize that, or does a generally healthy diet cover it? And I suppose because I put the boundary there because I'm pretty sure you're going to get the extreme case where maybe you do, but in the general case, yes or no?
generally speaking, if Mike went in and he had a pretty good diet and he were covering his energy needs and like he's, I there's nothing I would sort of say, oh, you know, you need to change this. If Mike said, well, kind of interested in getting a bit bigger, a bit stronger, what might you recommend from a supplement? I'd be like, okay, well, you know, there's some protein supplements that you might think about. They give you a little bit of an edge. Creatine, it's been around now for coming probably close to 35, 40 years. Benefits, you do get a bit bigger. Some people, you do get a little bit stronger. It's on my supplement shelf only because there is some evidence that suggests there's some cognitive benefits. So, which I'd appreciate maybe later in life. But outside of that, it gets pretty granular. Nothing nudges the needle further forward than actually going to the gym and lifting the weights. After that, it's just trying to put the icing on the cake or the sprinkles on the icing on the cake.
Mm. Well, Stuart Phillips, I know we've had taken many years to get hold of you, and we thank you very much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating, and you've answered a lot of questions for me, and I'm going to go to the gym after this, so I think it's going to be
awesome. There we go.
It's one of those things where the gym membership is sitting there idle, and I realize that I'm glad I've got it now, because now I know what to do. So twice a week I'm going to be at the gym. That's going to be my rest of the New Year's resolution.
Awesome.
Stuart, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Stuart.
You're most welcome, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.